The Monday Morning Tech Chat Show is brought to you by Audible. Audible is, of course, the premier audiobook service, perfect for folks who want their books read to them. Thousands and thousands of titles to choose from in all genres, sci-fi, fantasy, biographies, history, thrillers, mysteries, and more. We've got a great offer for listeners on this podcast, 2 free audiobooks when you sign up. And those books are yours to keep even if you decide to cancel your Audible subscription, which is $14.95 a month and gives you a free book every month of your choosing, as well as some other fun perks. Membership has its privileges. Hit up bit.ly/geekbookclub to start your free trial and get those 2 free books on lock. Once again, bit.ly/geekbookclub. And now, let's get into the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I am Juan Carlos Bagnell, some gadget guy, the SGG of this terribly named, horribly named podcast series. And of course, the QA stands for question and answer. I like to host my show on a Monday morning. We've had a little time to digest the news that came up last week. Maybe there was some breaking news over the weekend. We want to spend some time talking it out. Often on my podcast, where I aim for a 90-minute show, that's usually around 2 hours of talking out the news of the last week and making sure that we can kind of sort out our feelers, our techie, geeky feelers on some of the more important tech news, tech politics stories that are coming down the pipe. And that we can do this in a fairly interactive way. If you catch a show every Monday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific time, then you can also jump into the live chat and we can have a back and forth and we can share some thoughts in real time, IRL. Because I don't think, you know, anything that happens on the internet is fake. It's all real. So, you know, if you have a tech friend who you only interact with on social media, that's IRL. It's just they might not be an AFK friend. That was terrible. All right, let's get into some chat here. Abraham Artemis Aditya Anil commenting on my Wayland Yutani cap. So this cap has had a very storied history. I'm trying to purposely wear it out. Like I want to make it look as rough and as worn as what you see in the movie Alien. And my daughter helped a couple months back. We were leaving sort of a get together with some friends where, unbeknownst to us, she had had multiple servings of mac and cheese and people kept feeding her cookies and she was a very upset tummy little toddler and she vomited all over the back of my car and most of it was caught in this hat to try and avoid projectile toddler vomit around the rest of the car. And so it's taken a while to clean this hat back out. But if I wanted to wear it and, you know, make it all worn and beat up and bruised and battered, my daughter was game to help. She's a trooper. So that's the story. I always love starting off a tech podcast talking about toddler vomit. So let me just get a sip of water here. There is the not completely off the how do I want to say? Let me just take a sip of water here real quick. Abraham Artemis, game over, man. Game over. All right, Gary the Fireman. Actually, this week, I'm going to say let's jump right into housekeeping. There's no way I'm not going to run long on housekeeping today because there is actually some serious stuff to discuss. From last week to this week, we are still surrounded by wildfires in Southern California. The Sepulveda Basin fire was... If you've ever seen any of my camera reviews, you would know that I pick a couple landmarks very specifically. One of them is Lake Balboa. It's a little man-made lake. It's this beautiful little park. It's such a fun place to just walk around, get some fresh air, get some sunshine, and shoot some video. The street right behind Lake Balboa in my neighborhood was the street where the Sepulveda Basin fire went up. It's Woodley, Woodley Avenue off of Burbank Boulevard. So I shared a video and a couple photos from the location where I shoot some of those freeway shots in my neighborhood where you could see just the plumes of smoke coming off of around a 60-acre wildfire Thankfully, it never crossed Woodley. So while we got evacuation prep notifications, like we got those emergency alerts, prepare for evacuation, we didn't have to bug out from the Woodley fire. Unfortunately, last night, and one of the reasons why I'm going to be kind of loopy during this podcast, there's another fire on in the opposite direction that is currently heading towards our neighborhood. And it's also cutting off some access to some of the ways that we would run south, like Topanga Canyon. There are parts of the 405 that are shut down. And there's the very real possibility that I might get an alert, have to jet out right now, have to go grab my daughter and hit travel east, for lack of a better navigational description. Just so you know, if there's a sudden interruption in this podcast, or if data goes down, or if power gets cut, or something, we're kind of taking it on all sides right now, and it's very concerning. This whole morning, my daughter was talking about the scary dreams that she had that were all about fires, and she spent the morning stiff upper lip because she was going to be a firefighter. And she was going to fight the fires, and she was going to help save people that were in danger from the fires. And I mean, it was a touching and it was a heartwarming moment. But again, as a parent, you want to try and protect your child from scary things. But then you also, like, it's amazing and it's astounding when your child is actually fairly resilient on their own. Again, my wife and I were woken up probably every hour on the hour from the emergency alert notifications talking about this new fire up in the morning. The LA Fire Department, LAFD, has been incredible. It was the joint effort of around 140 firefighters, two fixed-wing craft and a helicopter, water support team pulling water out of Lake Balboa. That kept the Woodley fire, the Sepulveda Basin fire, at bay, and we're seeing a similar response for this other brush fire that just flared up. I say this a lot, and it's very frustrating to me when I say things like this, and people pedantically take me like hyper literal. But if you know a firefighter, if you see a firefighter, you bump into a firefighter, give them a nod, give them a fist bump, shake their hand, buy them a beer, buy them lunch, something.
Oh, right, Gadget Guy, like you really want to be giving beers to firefighters fighting wildfires.
How about if you're in Kansas right now and you don't have any wildfires or tornadoes or anything to deal with, you just go to your local fire department and just say thanks. These are people that are putting their lives at risk in some of the scariest conditions possible. And I don't feel like they get the proper care, the proper respect, or the proper attention for the jobs that they do. There's an outpouring for firefighter support whenever some crazy stuff goes down. But just, you know, when you're not in an emergency situation and you can, give them a nod, you know, let them know that their work is appreciated, because very few people in our society are really putting their lives on the line like that. So Gary the Fireman in our live chat, today is National First Responder Appreciation Day. I did not know that today was National First Responder Appreciation Day. And in my current situation, that is the perfect sentiment to start this podcast off with. from Peter Hayton, I have to say, I think the firefighters at the Cal Fire are some of the bravest people around. They do a great job, and make sure you all take care of one. I mean, the Southern California, the California firefighters, because we've got fires flaring up all over the state. We've got power outages hitting major parts of Northern and Central California. The work that they're doing with the resources they have is nothing short of phenomenal. It's amazing work. And then you start looking at the people that are actually going into the brush fires versus the people that are still having to handle the community. We got alerts on there were two just structure fires that happened near our house. So in addition to wildfires and brush, there are still just the normal, someone accidentally set their stove on fire. That's some situations that LAFD still has to respond to. This is true universally. This is true globally. I mean, if you're in New York right now, NYAFD, if you're in California, if you're in Washington State, if you're in Vancouver, this is an amazing subset of our society. The people that are in ambulances and fire engines, we love to trot them out and hold them up after a major calamity has happened. But I think one of the things that I'm going to do is after all of this has calmed down, hopefully, you know, like we don't face anything too severe and hopefully we don't see too many lives lost from these fires. But with the interest that my daughter has shown, like I'm going to have to take her by a fire station and just maybe have her drop off some donuts or something, like anything I can do to show some appreciation for the people that are that are putting their lives on the line. Gary the fireman, I'll train her. A detail and nil, some firefighter pixie. I don't want to make this like, oh, kids are so amazing and I'm a parent and what you need to know as a parent. My daughter surprises me on the regular. So her reaction to having scary dreams about fires was this very determined look of, I'm going to help other people. That's how I want to deal with these things. And anything I can do to kind of foster that sense of service, that's kind of incredible. Because I can't even I can't even claim credit for that. I'm not that good of a parent. Like, my daughter came to that on her own. All right, let's get into some real housekeeping here. Because again, if I do need to bug out, hopefully we can talk about some tech before I need to run out. So real housekeeping, the first bit of real housekeeping that I want to highlight from somegadgetguy.com. And again, all of the stories that we're going to talk about are going to be in the show notes, somegadgetguy.com. I'm going to try and do a better job of linking. So as I'm going through the podcast this week, I'll try and drop links in the live chat. But the first thing that I want to point to is literally just an upgrade for somegadgetguy.com. I am not a web developer. I host somegadgetguy.com on a WordPress.org stock theme. I am not doing anything fancy. You can tell when you go to somegadgetguy.com. This is not a hyper-professionally built website, but it's like literally the best I can do with the resources I have and still being able to manage video and editorial content production. So I got an alert. WordPress sent me an alert saying, hey, by the way, you should probably update your PHP. I don't know what that means, WordPress, but thanks. I'll look into it. It took me a couple days. Again, I'm not proud of this. I'm real bad at this. But I was running PHP 5.5, 5.6. And PHP 7.3 is the current like bleeding edge of website hosting and sharing this content. So I back up my website. I've had way too many experiences of like, oh, I'll just update this plugin. And then the website disappears and some gadget guy just goes dark for 2 days while I try and figure out how to restore the site from an aged backup and replace all the content that I've lost. Thankfully, nothing like that happened. But now PHP is up to date. And surprisingly, the site is actually significantly faster. Who knew that when your web protocol is like years out of date that can have an impact on performance. So when you go to somegadgetguy.com now, it should load a little quicker if you use the search or if you click and open a story. You won't have that big lag, rough transition where you could see individual pictures getting built into the website because everything was so slow. The caching is faster, the support is faster. It's good times. So with that being said, with everything going on, my daughter's fourth birthday was last week. We surprised her down at Disneyland. It wasn't the reaction I thought we were going to get. She actually thought that we'd made a mistake, that we were just going to go to a hotel with Poppy and Grandma. And then we roll up on Disneyland and she's like, wait, this wasn't part of the plan. No, I think we should go back to the hotel. Like she was really concerned. I didn't get a lot of video done over the last week. I was working on there was a Newegg segment that we're going to be talking about here in just a bit in the housekeeping. And then also, I do contract work for a couple other brands. So I was putting together a video that will hopefully get some bills paid. But I did get some writing done. I got some writing done on my Pixelbook Go, which we'll talk about later in the show. But the first article that I want to highlight is a discussion on worth. So the title of the article is "Silly Tech Geeks, of course the Pixel 4 is worth $100 more than the iPhone 11. I have a very difficult time not raging at tech enthusiasts. I find the commentary to be very frustrating when tech geeks love to circle up and talk about how worth and value, those are totally relative concepts and people should just buy what they like. And then in like the very next breath, they're pontificating on the value of a gadget and how the only way a company can compete is if they slash prices and they should of made things cheaper while putting in more features, and these are absolute deal breakers because prices and because market and because popularity. It doesn't take much rational analysis to see where there is an argument that objectively a company could be charging $100 more for the Pixel 4 over the iPhone 11, not the iPhone 11 Pro. I don't see any difficulty there. This is pretty easy commentary when we break down a specs list, when we look at support, when we look at the display, when we look at the development on software and packages and even just literally the hardware that goes into these phones. And then a consumer can make an informed decision on whether or not they value what goes into a phone to charge that $100 premium. So instead of trying to come up with some sort of streamlined way or like a couple minute video where I highlight some of this, I wrote like a 2000 word essay on why it's pretty clear why a Pixel 4 is worth $100 more than an iPhone 11. So you can check out that article and tell me how I'm wrong. That's a fun debate. See, that's what I like, is I like being able to pick at different elements of a debate and then we can sort out our feelings from there. But I'm getting really tired of this. The same thing happened with the LG G8. Oh, it's too expensive and there's no way LG can compete and it doesn't do anything better than a Samsung. And you're like, well, none of that's true. And, oh, you can get a Samsung on sale for this. And you're like, yeah, and you can get an LG G8 on sale. And you can get a Pixel 4 XL on sale. I mean, like, if you're talking about sales, it's pretty likely that a Pixel 4 over its life cycle will probably have more aggressive sales than any iPhone will. So this common knowledge, I don't even think Google can compete against the cheap iPhone, doesn't really hold water if we're supposedly, as tech geeks, more rational than general consumers. Instead, we're just feeding into some sort of predetermined bias as to what phone we think is going to perform better and we want to be on the winning team. If that's your argument, that you just want to be on team popular, well, then that's fine. But at least own that argument and don't try and make it some kind of like, oh, well, objectively, this is the correct idea, but people should buy what they want. But objectively, this is a problem. But worth and value are relative. But objectively, this is correct. You know, I'm kind of tired of kind of talking out both sides of our mouth with conflicting philosophies. To that point, I figured, what was it that what was it that I could really do to test my own feelings, my own assertions? I'm reviewing the Pixel 4 XL. This is the phone that has my SIM card in it, my Google Fi. This is the phone. I'm really trying to give it a good run while using the Pixel 4 XL. I'm finding it exceptionally difficult to put down my LG V50. When I say this is my favorite phone of the year, I mean that in a very profound sense. Using the cameras, using the audio. I was in bed last night. I was kind of playing a game. My wife rolls over. She wants to go to bed. I reach over for some headphones, and I can't just plug them into my Pixel 4 XL because I'm not stocking dongles all over the place. Little things like that, man, make it real tricky. So for me, and my background and the capabilities that I care about, the most difficult fight I could put the Pixel 4 XL up against is the LG V50. So for $1,000, we have tremendously different ideas on what constitutes an expensive premium phone. And again, where we used to try and do a lot of these types of videos over at Pocket Now, whenever I try and break this down into a video, it's like I've got to cut so much of the commentary out. So instead of trying to make this a punchy, quick 4-minute video, I just wrote it all out. Like, from my perspective, here's a little philosophy leading into what I consider valuable in a phone comparison, why I don't like making reviews, implied comparisons, and then just really try and break it all down. So, you know, a section on display, design, the haptic feedback, the audio tech, the cameras, the software. That's an easy win for the Pixel. Performance in terms of radios, performance in terms of applications and how fast the Pixel 4 XL has been, battery life, and then also security issues, storage, and trying to draw some kind of conclusion, which isn't just worth is relative and value is up to the individual consumer and you should buy what you like, because no tech reviewers like LG or Google right now, apparently. So more than anything else, I'm just trying to get the point across that buying a phone should be more like buying a car. You set a budget and then you should look at what options you have in your budget. Are you a multimedia consumption junkie? Are you a content creator? Are you a gamer? Are you trying to work on databases or spreadsheets? Or do you do a lot of writing? Maybe you would want to move some of your writing to a phone. We should be examining all of the different opportunities and all of the different solutions for what a consumer might be able to shop to get the exact right fit for them, not what's the most popular option so that you're on Team Popular, hashtag Team Popular. So I really personally enjoyed putting this down in writing, getting these articles published in a written form as opposed to trying to make them the most entertaining versions of a comparison video where, again, a lot of people are just going to look at the title and then drop a comment and then get on with their day. I really feel like I'm going to move more of my commentary to written articles like this, as opposed to trying to impress people with video after video after video of showdowns, which then just kind of become spec reading comparisons. I don't enjoy that, and I don't think a lot of people like watching that, so we can kind of shake that up a bit. From DKRY, the Mixer stream is laggy for some reason. The Twitter stream is fine. Good to know. I have no control over the Mixer stream mid-broadcast because I'm going through Restream. But like I said, I won't be too surprised if there is some kind of data or electricity interruption in the middle of this podcast. Who knows what could be messing all of this up. From Doomer, if you think about it, the iPhone XR sold so well, it became the base model of the iPhone 11 series. Costs, again, and especially for the XR, because Apple was still charging, I think, a very high premium for what you got on a XR. And I think we saw Apple course correct correctly on the price positioning for the iPhone 11. I think it's very interesting that our value and our worth in being relative for each consumer setting their own value and their own worth, that we keep bringing up these are absolute deal breakers on a Pixel, and it's exactly the same kind of business practice for an iPhone. Yeah, like 64 gigabytes of storage. That's a bummer. But it's just as much a bummer on an iPhone as it is on a Pixel. And yet we're not talking about the iPhone 11 as being, not worth it. We're actually saying, like, that's a good price for a base model starter iPhone price for a premium handset. So again, we like to move the goalposts a lot when we talk about one feature being the winner or one feature being a deal breaker. Gary the Fireman, as a Pixel 2 XL owner, the 4 really seems disappointing. The 6 gigabytes of RAM, 128 gigabyte max storage, losing full resolution backup on Google Photos really left a bad taste in my mouth. I'm going to get a new battery and see what the 5 brings, or I'm going to move to OnePlus. That's actually one of the next articles that I'm planning, is a OnePlus versus Pixel comparison. There's a philosophy at play, and a part of this will be mentioned during my OnePlus comparison, and a part of this will be saved for my full Pixel 4 XL review. But I don't think Google has done a very good job of describing their philosophy. The Pixel only exists as a platform to showcase the bleeding edge of Google services. It's not exactly the same as, say, a Microsoft Surface. Where Microsoft had trouble with Windows 8 to Windows 10, their partners, their hardware partners, weren't really experimenting with any new or exciting designs or incorporating touch screens. They were leaning on Lenovo a lot to try and get multi-mode computing into the hands of consumers. And eventually they said, no, we've actually got to drive the market a little bit and show consumers how far we can push this Windows experiment, because Dell and HP aren't going to get it done. I think there was an expectation that the Pixel was going to be that, but it's not. Google is a software company, and those software experiences are kind of incredible. I've already tweeted about it, so this isn't any big surprise, but it's sort of magical. Okay, I got a pick on TechAlter. So TechAlter just recently tweeted, I think it was late last night or early this morning, I can't remember because I had emergency alerts going off all night. But TechAlter did that thing. You know, we complain about tech geeks when they're like, oh, you like that feature on your phone? Well, so-and-so had it first. Samsung had a recorder app that transcribed speech into text. Quite a few services have had speech-to-text capabilities. This isn't new. I actually have two videos, sort of mocking a Masterpiece Theater-style delivery, but, you know, a phone using Google's speech-to-text transcription in a standalone app, reading off movie reviews. And I don't know why I did it. The videos didn't do very well, and it really wasn't a very good concept, but it was to show off this new speech-to-text engine. And I want to say it was back in, like, I don't even remember, like, maybe Android. No, it wasn't. Maybe it was Android M. I can't remember. Anyway, not important. But again, TechAlter bringing it up as if, like, well, I mean, I don't understand why everyone's so hyped up about this now. Samsung had it before. And you're like, tweets like that, I feel like kind of miss the point. When I bring up, you know, LG had wide-angle cameras first, it's because we are trying to point towards where the market is evolving, how people are commenting on things like, oh, you don't have a wide-angle camera now? Deal breaker. Well, last year, you didn't think it was a deal breaker, and there were some good options for a wide-angle camera last year. So pump the brakes. But what's exciting about the Pixel isn't that it's got speech-to-text transcription in this recorder app. It's that the speech-to-text transcription happens on device and it's system-wide. So it works in your recorder app, but it also works on every single piece of audio that the phone handles. And I showed a screen grab of a video that I had uploaded to my OneDrive, because I use OneDrive for all my cloud storage. And it's a video of my daughter explaining her Duplo rocket ship that she just built. And the Pixel 4 is able to transcribe toddler speak in real time, streaming off of a Microsoft Cloud Service account. How do you not think that's cool? Like, that is a profound improvement over Samsung's Recorder app, which had to have a data connection to upload your audio to a Samsung server to get the transcription working. That is a marked difference in performance. That is a significant difference in application. And that's exactly where I want the market to go. I want to see the market. I want to see phones do more on device and less cloud. I want less of my information going up to servers to be analyzed, and I want more of it happening in my hand. So if we're only going to say Snapdragon 855 and 6 gigapixels of RAM and, you know, a wide angle camera or deal breaker, then I think we're missing the point of what Google's trying to accomplish. It's not to say that's the correct option. I'll never be the guy to tell you how to spend your money. But to disregard the phone as an option means that we ignore a chunk of the consumer base that will do really well with the closest Google experience that you can get to an iPhone. I look at my dad. I think my dad's kind of the perfect example of this. He doesn't like his Samsung. He had a Pixel 2 and he lost it. He's real bad about keeping track of his gadgets. We've gone through multiple media players and smartphones that probably didn't need to be replaced, but just got left in an airplane. He had a Pixel 2 and he loved it. He has a Galaxy S8 and he hates it. And he'll probably go back to a Pixel next year. Maybe not the Pixel 4. Maybe it'll be the Pixel 5. But the thing is, he's also in his Lexus years. So he has kind of a value for a more premium feel device, what have you. So he's not likely, even though he doesn't need more computing power than a Pixel 3a, he'll lean towards the nicer phone and he'll want the more streamlined and the smoother interface and knowing that software updates are going to come directly from Google. And he kind of uses the camera every once in a while. He's been using the camera on his phone a little bit more now that, you know, my daughter's here and he has a granddaughter. But no, I mean, like, for him, it's reading articles online. He'll want the better screen. And he loves looking up, like, restaurant reviews. You know, like, he's always doing navigation for what restaurant has a few more dollar signs and we can get a nice steak or something like that. It's a very Lexus kind of use for a man his age. There are a few phones that I would recommend to him outside of a Pixel. My mom is the opposite. My mom is that gearhead, tech nerd, bang for buck kind of person. And when we went through the entire roster of phones here in the gadget lab, she decided on a OnePlus 6T. Like, she wanted a little hot rod. She wanted a bang for buck. And she wanted something that was a little funky and a little different. Mom and dad, very different consumers when it comes to technology and products and labels and what they like to wear and what they like to sport. So that to me becomes, we can find, this isn't difficult. There are people out there that the Pixel 4 will be a great fit for because of that software argument. Just acting like, oh, it should have had an 855 plus and 10 gigabytes of RAM and a wide angle camera, so it's a deal breaker. Just that's not how tech is really shopped for. That's not how tech is really consumed. So we can do better. That being said, it is a real bummer not having full resolution photo backups. Oh, Goran Petrovic, Tech Alter is an LG defender. Tech Alter, the reason why I like Tech Alter's commentary in his video so much is because I don't really feel like he even, that he's so much an LG defender. I have to be very careful because I personally like LG, so I have to not, I have to be very judicious in how often I shill for them. But Tech Alter, again, the reason why I like his stuff so much is he's first and foremost, he's for competition. I mean, he brings up these points because we want the market to be better educated and we want consumers to know about their options. If a Samsung consumer is feeling bummed out that they don't have speech-to-text transcription in a Recorder app, It's right to mention, by the way, your Samsung Recorder app has speech-to-text transcription, so don't feel too bad. But again, I want to point out where we see progress is where we see competition. Where we see competition, we will see progress. And I feel like TechAlter is cut from a very similar market analysis. Let's see. Doomer, gigapickles. That's new. Savory, delicious gigapickles. I couldn't remember what I used to say for RAM. Because I have giggle flips for making fun of people that get nerded out about processor benchmarks. And then megapickles for camera sensor. I used to have something for RAM. It wasn't worth remembering. Two other real quick bits of housekeeping. I'm just going to tag these back to back. This was big embargo launch day. Intel Core i9-9900KS. This was the video that I was producing down at Newegg. It's a pretty candid interview. We have a rep from Intel come on, and we discuss what's going on with the 9900, the K, the KS, the KF, some of the differences between these different processor models. I've gotten a lot of pushback on this commentary, like, what is Intel doing? This doesn't need to exist. They're totally failing. Now, AMD has put out some great processors. I'm currently running a Threadripper in my workstation at right now, what's actually streaming this. We've got to stop thinking about everything as winners and losers. The fact that AMD is striking out with some competitive products is very good thing for Intel, for Intel fans. It's not a very good thing for Intel. It's a very good thing for Intel fans because now Intel is looking at improving their binning. The KS is not just a cheap overclock of the 9900K. We actually got to play around with it a little before we did the interview at Newegg. I mean, we can't put out, I don't know that we can put out benchmarks and stuff, but anyway. Intel actually had to look at their manufacturing process. They're on an older fabrication process. We don't know when their next gen die shrink is going to happen. But that doesn't mean that you can't get a great price performance ratio when Intel's on the ropes and they have to cut prices to compete against the new series of AMD chipsets. That is a good thing. If you were looking at building a new system, you now have better price performance options from Intel because AMD is competing so well. And you kind of get a sense that Intel, at least the Intel product reps that I was able to speak with, sort of understand their position right now. And they're working really hard at doing other things too, like better overclocking capabilities. They're trying to create new services for people to stream easier. They've got a new streaming setup. If you've ever had to set up OBS, it's a little intimidating when you first set it up. So their value add proposition is getting healthier because AMD is setting out on some new technologies that Intel is falling a little behind on. That doesn't mean anyone shopping a Team Blue computer build is in the wrong. It's good to have some competition. Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together. From Abraham Artemis, it only means there's finally competition and that tech isn't stagnant anymore. It would also be nice if we had more than two players in this race, but that's also where my commentary has been coming in. I think both Intel and AMD are going to get rocked by ARM chipsets. I'm using a Pixelbook Go. I'm trying to do more work from phones. I don't feel, anyone that I've spoken to at AMD or at Intel, I don't feel they fully grasp how aggressive ARM is going to come in for traditional consumer computing solutions. I don't think either of them have a good solution to combat the power performance, the battery life advantages, and a whole consumer base that are going to be trained on apps as opposed to legacy x86 software. Even Apple is trying to move laptop consumers over to iPads. There are these huge gaps in AMD and Intel's lineup where mobile kit is going to start replacing desktop kit. From Do More, doesn't the Pixelbook Go have Intel? It does, and we're going to talk about that. That's why I mentioned it in a comparison against how I get work done on my phone. I wonder which products are performing better, Intel-powered Chrome OS or Qualcomm-powered Android? It's a mystery. And one last little bit of housekeeping. We're finally done with housekeeping 30 minutes into this podcast. I took a guest appearance on the Android Police podcast. If you don't get enough of me rambling on, you can hear a lovely conversation with the folks over at AP. And we talked about some crazy stuff. Some of the things we're going to be talking about in this one, RCS messaging, the Red phone, a crazy story about mafia people building a phone company built on security and then murdering folks. A good time was had by all in a podcast about murder. Lots of different murders in that podcast. And you can also check that out too. All right, let's get into some news. We have to start off with tech and politics. Going to try and keep this a little bit more efficient because it's some frustrating stuff. So coming by way of The Verge, let me drop this into the live chat right now. The FCC is using streaming services as an excuse to raise cable rates. I'm not going to do my normal thing where I read through the article. I really hope, folks, that you will take some time to read through some of these. Anytime there's an FCC story like this, especially as it pertains to net neutrality and market competition, we've got to stay on top of this. It's some really scary stuff. To sum up this article, there is a rule that if there is only one cable or broadband provider in an area, market rates are regulated by the FCC. If there's no competition, then if there is a true regional monopoly, your market rates are regulated by the Federal Communications Commission. Charter Communication and the FCC are now arguing that if a service like AT&T exists, so you have cell phone service with AT&T, and AT&T is bundling some kind of streaming service into that solution, that they no longer are a monopolistic entity in that space. So the Federal Communications Commission, who is supposed to help regulate how we handle monopolies, is actually trying to entrench cable and broadband monopolies and allow them to raise rates. Charter has been public in saying and has confirmed that as soon as they have the opportunity to, that they will be raising rates in any region where they are the sole provider for landline broadband solutions. And the FCC is supporting their initiative to be a monopoly and to be able to set their own rates free of any kind of outside regulation. So as long as you have access to Hulu on any kind of data connection outside of what Charter offers, that's competition. That's real competition. As long as you can consume your YouTubes and Netflixes on any type of solution, then a cable or a broadband company will be allowed to set whatever rate they want. From MavMech13 on the Mixer, I hate Charter. Just throwing that out there. Literally, like every single mega ISP is like the most hated company in their region. As soon as I have any option to give my money to someone other than Spectrum, I will give them my money, even if it means having to get in bed with like AT&T Giga Fiber, whatever they're calling it this month. If Verizon were to offer fiber, I would seriously consider switching teams. Charlie Spirit Song. I think FCC is trying to zone spaces so that company A monopolizes area A, company B monopolizes area B. So the companies have already made their agreements. In most regions, there is almost no competition because it's just more profitable not to compete. If we're talking about free market economics, it's way cheaper for companies. They save way more money not going into a well-serviced area, not competing, and then eventually consolidating. So, you know, Comcast buys up smaller broadband providers. That's what a completely unregulated free market will look like a giant amoeba of big companies swallowing up little companies and then not spending money to improve their service or to compete or to fight against other areas. So that's bad. Oh, Matt Tyler just joined the live stream, but you didn't miss much, Matt, because housekeeping was a half hour this week. Moving right along, this is another horrific FCC story. I've got to shift. And then let me get this copied and shared in the live chat. I've got to find a better way of streamlining all of my links so that I can share these out faster. So this is coming by way of the Next Web. EgyptPie wants to abolish federalism so Verizon and AT&T can throttle your data. I take issue with this headline from Tristan Green because AT&T and Verizon already throttle your data. We've already shown that on the podcast numerous times before. Like fire up a video streaming service, and even if there is no network congestion, your data will be throttled. So that's already a thing. The FCC getting rid of net neutrality has basically opened the floodgates for terrible anti-consumer business practices. But this is a new low. What is federalism, you might ask? Federalism is states' rights. You know, we covered this a couple weeks back. The FCC abdicated their responsibility when they abolished net neutrality. They claim they are not allowed to regulate the telecommunications space. So a bunch of states started fronting their own net neutrality regulations, their own legislation. And the FCC sued them to say, we can't regulate the internet and you can't either. And a number of courts have been striking down this claim. So, you know, the net neutrality bill that was just passed here in California, the bill that's going up in New York, in Washington state. And I want to say there's roughly 20 states that have net neutrality legislation in some form of the legislative process. Well, we can't have that. That's even worse for cable companies and ISPs and cell phone carriers. Instead of just one federal net neutrality standard, which was pretty weak, if you look at what the open internet order actually contained, every single time Verizon sued the federal government or has gotten in the way of net neutrality regulations, the regulations get worse. So not only are these mega corporations terrible at their jobs, they're making their own jobs more difficult because now they're going to have 20 different variations of net neutrality to comply with in every state that has some form of net neutrality on the books. Well, what is EgyptPie's genius solution for this? Well, you know, federalism is a problem. He argued that while, let me take this, this is a quote from the Next Web. I'm trying to highlight it here. Okay. He argued that while that federalist system has served us very well up to this point in our nation's history, it's time for Congress to consider whether or not we can still maintain a multi-layer regulatory system. He said allowing states and local governments to pass their own laws regulating internet services, which inherently cross state lines, creates market uncertainty. When you're talking about the choice for a venture capitalist or an entrepreneur to set up shop in the United States where they have to get permission from the federal government or from the state of California, San Francisco, or some other jurisdiction, or whether they should set up shop in country B, where there's a uniform, well-established set of regulations that are consistent, I worry that the proposition value for country B will become stronger over time. Ajit Pai's solution for the variety of local net neutrality laws is to get rid of states' rights. I want that to sink in for a second. He has a problem with one of the cornerstones of American government. Federalism is that pesky rock in his shoe that keeps getting in his way because he wanted to get rid of the open internet order, which established a universal set of regulations at the federal level. He created this problem, and now his solution is, well, states can't have rights. We need the federal government to come in and tell everybody that they can't regulate what they want, what their citizens want to regulate. I want to listen to like more libertarian leaning and conservative viewpoints on this kind of stuff. If you're someone of the more conservative persuasion, maybe the more libertarian persuasion, I feel like we have a common enemy in someone like Ajit Pai. I am obviously a more liberal leftist leaning individual, but Ajit Pai is making y'all look real bad. I mean, what just came out of his face complaining about states' rights is proper dumb. That's a bad look. And I feel like if you were on team Elephant or just, you know, not so left-leaning like me, you'd probably want him out of the way because I seriously doubt he represents your views on market competition as enforced by a federal government that is trying to abolish states' rights. I'm just saying, it's a bad look. Charlie Spirit Song, I think Ajit Pai will end up being one of the most hated human beings on earth, not just the USA. From Andrew Wallace is in the live chat. Everyone say hey to Fat Produce. People appointed by the Trump administration practicing blatant corruption within their respective organizations? Hashtag shocking. From MavMech13 on Mixer. Sounds about right. The guy's a douche anyway. from Charlie Spearsum. How come the more Ajit Pai proposes something, the more it looks as if he's digging a bigger hole just to cover up his previous holes? I mean, that's a perfect summation. He's in charge of a commission which regulates things, and his big argument is this commission shouldn't be allowed to regulate things. This is regulatory capture. This is he was one of the schmuckier representatives, lobbyists in support of the telecommunications industry's terrible business practices. And that's kind of exactly what he's doing. He is an agent of chaos. He is there to break how these systems work. And out of the chaos, we will find beneficial conditions for mega corporations to continue business practices that we all despise. And again, we would be doing better with better competition and better infrastructure and reaching out to rural communities and looking at healthcare and education and tying all of this stuff into the backbone of our future data and electrical grid infrastructure. But we can't get there when chuckleheads like this are standing in our way. I mean, even if he were a legit old school conservative, we would still be seeing some form of progress as to business, telecommunications, infrastructure, jobs, programs, All of these things tie into liberal agenda and conservative agenda. They don't ally with wealth extraction agenda. So if the only thing that you have on your plate is, I need to help mega corporations squeeze more money out of people and prevent anything which might stop them from some of the most anti-consumer policy possible, then EduPie's your guy. All right, let's get out of EduPie and the FCC. Got some pretty good comments in there. I can't read through all of them, but trust me, you guys are cracking me up. How about we talk a little space and science and military application? Because I didn't know that this was a continuing project. And let me share the NPR article, but I'm going to share a slightly better photo on screen. Space stuff is really cool. I want there to be like some actual taxpayer initiatives for building space vehicles. My dad is retired Air Force. So while I hope that not all of our spacefaring experiments will be funded by the military, just the fact that I didn't know that this was continuing. This is the United States Air Force's secret space drone, which looks kind of like a Predator drone and a space shuttle had a baby. And it's been out in space for 780 days, and it just returned safely all on its own. Ruru 2 sharing Space Force logo. This is kind of badass. From a very short NPR article, a secret Air Force space plane lands after more than 2 years in orbit, a record-breaking 780 days circling the Earth. The U.S. Air Force's mysterious X-37B unmanned space plane dropped out of orbit and landed safely on the same runway that the space shuttle once used. It was the fifth acknowledged mission for the vehicle built by Boeing at the aerospace company's Phantom Works. So again, if you followed like spacecraft design, I was a huge fan of some of those ramjet experiments. My grandfather used to work on some of the switches and the electrical for back when they were classified planes like the B-1 bomber. He kind of instilled in me a passion for just crazy aeronautical experiments. Like he had models of the SR-71 all over his garage. And I just, again, I adore just the crazy bleeding edge experimental tip of the spear when it comes to putting a human in some type of vehicle, what goes real, real fast. So I had read up on the X-37 and you've seen some of those like, you know, Skunk Works drawings, what the thing could possibly look like. And then you just get an image of this on a runway and that this is real. And that this is real. And because they're allowing us to see this, there's probably crazier stuff out there too. So this is pretty awesome stuff. Matt Tyler, not enough everyone spying on everyone. Now there's a damn space spying machine unmanned. So if I'm reading through some of the other articles and some of the other stories about the X-37B, that this is a drone. This is an unmanned vehicle, but that the whole point of this program is to facilitate manned missions. That the next generation of aircraft in general, but then also space flying aircraft, will be more drone like, with a higher with a larger reliance on automated systems. Obviously pilots will still be in the mix, but hopefully to make manned missions safer. And that the United States Air Force is apparently putting a ton of money into the development of these new platforms and services. I kind of like that. I kind of feel like, yes, there should be a private industry, corporations that are trying to weigh in on space flight and missions to outer space. Tesla, I mean, Elon Musk with SpaceX, and I can't remember what's the name of Amazon, Jeff Bezos's company. I don't want the future of spacefaring humanity to be tied completely to mega corporations. I want there to be some other component where maybe government-funded research, taxpayer-funded research can also contribute and hopefully also compete against what Amazon might want to do with spaceships. So that's just my take on it. Matt Tyler is very skeptical about these spying and spaceships in the military. NASA, how do we explain it? Trump, tell them it's to facilitate manned missions. NASA, got ya. Something tells me NASA and Trump aren't on the best of speaking terms right now. And that if we're going to front for any part of our government, I feel like being excited about NASA is probably better than digging into more Trump stuff. So we've got this is another political story, but again, tying into things that I think are very passionate in the tech community. And this is another twofer coming by way of Vice. Lawmaker kills repair bill because cell phones are throwaways. So this was in New Hampshire. I want to see if I can get to, I can't pronounce this guy's name, Petusek. He's a Republican in the New Hampshire State House. Basically, he was one of the deciding members of this committee that helped kill a right to repair bill. We're seeing this a lot. There are numerous right to repair bills going up in state legislatures, and a lot of them are facing significant pushback from major players. Microsoft helped shut down the right to repair bill in Washington and in California. Apple has been very against right to repair legislation to the point of making their phones slightly easier to get official parts for, but not really. But see, you don't need right to repair. We'll help you fix your phone until we won't. So New Hampshire had a bill go up. It got shut down. And one of the most vocal opponents to this right to repair bill, Petusek, in the near future, cell phones are throwaways. Everyone will just get a new one. Which is, of course, the problem we're trying to solve with right to repair legislation. This week's poll on the Twitch, if you scroll just under the Twitch video, that if you're in the live stream you're watching right now, but you can go to twitch.tv/somegadgetguy. Would you trade some features for a removable battery again? Like, how about it's just easier to open your phone and maybe you have to give up water resistance, right? You can vote in that poll. Leave your thoughts. Hit me up in, you know, comments, whatever. I keep picking up phones like my Note 4 where it's super easy if I want to swap that battery out because I'm a grown-up and I can do that. And maybe I have to trade IP68 for IP52. You know, like it's just lightly splash resistant. It's not going to be, I can submerge it in a puddle or in a swimming pool for 20 minutes. Okay. But I like being able to change my own battery. And that's sort of strikes at the core of right to repair legislation for a good, I think some very good talking points, well articulated with some passion and with some humor. There was a follow-up committee hearing in Massachusetts. A lobbyist went to try and shut down a right to repair bill in the Boston in a Boston committee hearing, and none other than one Mr. Louis Rossman went to go and testify. And so he starts out by showing some of the arguments being used by the lobbyist against the bill. And I feel he is passionate and articulate and able to dismantle some terrible arguments being made against consumers. And even with the follow-up questions where he's put on the spot to say like, well, I mean, can you demonstrate that you've been harmed by this kind of action? He's like, yeah, it's pretty clear. It's easy to see. And again, his ability to respond and to react while he's obviously anxious, you know what I mean? Like, that is a very difficult situation to be in, facing elected officials and sitting in front of the microphone and replying to a corporate shill right off your side. He handles himself so well. I've put the link in the live chat. It'll be in the show notes. Give it a watch. This was part of a almost 3 hour committee meeting. His section is 8 minutes long. It's like 8 or 9 minutes long. And just watching him speak about something that he is obviously very knowledgeable about should give us all a little hope that hopefully we can that some ownership of our technology will return to us. It's very disappointing that our elected officials, while they're getting better, are still so tech illiterate that they fall for some very, very bad arguments as to why consumers should not be allowed to fix their products, or repair shops should be denied good parts for repairs. This is going to be a pretty brutal fight, because companies like Apple have a vested interest in selling us new stuff. They want us to flip our gadgets more aggressively. They don't have the same reliability argument in play anymore. That's not what builds a company's reputation anymore. Instead, it's, well, it's 2 years old. You should get rid of it. And I mean, I'm seeing some notes in the live chat that apparently Apple just talked about their new AirPods. So what happens with older AirPods? How will they be properly recycled? You can't open the casing on AirPods very easily. It's actually kind of dangerous for a consumer to try and get in there, and you can't replace anything anyway. So a number of these products, a significant percentage of those products are just going to end up in landfills. Precious materials, precious metals, dangerous chemicals, explosive components, all of that's just going to get thrown in the garbage. Because we also make it very difficult to properly dispose of this stuff. It's expensive or it's inconvenient. We need to be doing better than this. We talked about maybe even a couple months back about the EU trying to combat this tsunami of e-waste that's being generated. In the UK, establishing legislation to try and curb planned obsolescence. So you get a new washing machine, and it's got a bunch of computer bits in there, and it's designed to kind of burn out after a couple years. Legislation probably won't do a whole lot, but it's a start. It's some acknowledgement that there's this humongous problem staring us right in the face, and that we're throwing away expensive stuff way more aggressively than we should be. Mavtech 13 on the mixer. I've been talking about that for a while. That was part of the reason I bought the V20 some years back. And Matt Tyler following that up right on Twitch. LG V20 was a good compromise with a premium build and a removable battery. And who knew that when we were reviewing the V20 that was going to be it? That was the last premium phone that had an easily user replaceable battery. All gone. We also lost IR blasters, and I'm still cranky about that. From Baraketh, the Galaxy S5 had IP67 and a removable battery. That didn't work well, though. Anytime you have a removable battery, one of the most common instances of testing water resistance is probably going to be from a drop. You drop your phone into something, and as soon as you dropped a Galaxy S5, you instantly defeated the water resistance. The water resistance was only good for spilling something on the phone, or like gently placing the phone into some kind of fluid, which in my brain isn't something that's likely to happen as often as dropping your phone. Like, you're outside, it's raining, you drop your phone, it lands in a puddle, it's completely submerged. In so many of those situations, a glass back phone or a removable back phone, you're going to compromise the water resistance through some kind of damage or cracking. If the back pops open, you don't have a water resistant phone anymore. So it's like HTC got so much crap with the HTC 10 that it was only IP53. But IP53 is pretty adequate for a lot of the consumer spills, getting your phone out in some rain. Like, that's not a deal breaker. And if I could get IP53, like a good, genuinely rated IP53 with a removable back, that would make me really happy. From Fat Produce, that hearing with Luis Rossman was freaking epic. I highly recommend you watch that video. He speaks so well on this topic. Matt Tyler, build phones with the strength of an LG V10. That thing was a tank. Again, I wouldn't mind returning to a grippy back and stainless steel rails. That thing was pretty brutal. from Baraketh, my nephew was using my Note 4 after I got my Pixel. He killed it by dropping it into the toilet. Yeah, it happens to a few phones. Abraham Artemis. So too many people who are still out of touch, still in power, basically. And again, since money is speech, when they get educated on a topic, it's going to be from people more often from corporations that have a vested interest in maintaining their status quo. That is unsustainable. It's really not sustainable for us to be churning. And I acknowledge I am a part of this problem by reviewing and getting excited over tech. I love this stuff. But increasingly, in my social circles and even here in public forums, I am desperately now trying to reverse course on trading our technology as often as we do. That I really want us to be holding on to these things longer. In my family, I feel like that message is starting to resonate. My sister and her husband only this year traded in their Motorola G4s for Pixel 3As. And I'm feeling pretty confident that the Pixel 3A, for how my sister and her husband use their phones, will probably be three-year devices. That's really what I want to see more consumers acknowledge, or more tech enthusiasts acknowledge, that consumers, not tech geeks, regular average users, are trying to hold onto their phones for 3 years or more. That's what we should be looking at. Those of us who are fans of this stuff will always be more inclined to flip this stuff more aggressively. But if we can't get 3 years out of this hardware, and if we can't get 3 years out of this software, we've got very real challenges and very big problems. And unfortunately, our elected officials and our lawmakers, not well-versed enough, not savvy enough to completely help us through this if they're primarily going to listen to lobbyists. Abraham Artemis, no IP68. How will I submerge my phone in a pool? Maybe just handle your phone better. From MavMac13, I have made this point before. Thank you for making this comment. I think a lot of people actually hate to change their phones. We have exhausted consumers. Tech is not exciting. It is such a burden for the average consumer to transfer their stuff over to a new phone. The process of getting my mom off of her Galaxy S5 and onto a OnePlus 6T was 2 months from soup to nuts. Getting her to set up the phone, she had to get a different SIM card. She had to transfer information over. Thankfully, she had already been using like Gmail and Google's contacts, so that wasn't too big of a problem. But Samsung's messaging app was miserable for the photos that she was getting texts from her friends. She had to manually go through and back up photos from texts and then put them on a memory card. But then the OnePlus 6T can't use memory cards, so she had to use a USB drive. I mean, like, it was, for someone who is a gearhead, she's a computer scientist. She's got a degree in programming. It was miserable for her, like moving her phone over. So again, I feel like those of us as tech geeks and tech nerds, a little more compassion, and then helping facilitate longer use. We could be doing better. Because this isn't fun for a lot of people anymore. It was fresh and it was new and it was exciting when the iPhone 3G came out. Oh, man, this is so sweet. Now, no, no, this isn't fun anymore. It's an obligation. It's a commodity. It's a burden. And switching is like going to the dentist for a lot of people. Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon and my Audible campaign, I can hook you up with a $20 voucher if you're shopping a new OnePlus, or you can grab a ton of great video games for cheap with Humble Bundle Monthly. I also have a teaser image on that page for my upcoming Mega Pickle coffee mug, which will hopefully be available for purchase soon. SomeGadgetGuy.com, link at the top of the site, support Some Gadget Guy, and hopefully you find something cool, something you might like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch. LFA reviews, the Galaxy S5 was such a good device. I mean, just think about all of the things we've lost since the S5. I'm going to be doing a video on air gestures, and the S5 was the last year of Samsung properly implementing some kind of air control in their phones. IR blaster, headphone jack, covered port for the micro USB, not super great, but at least some rated IP67, replaceable battery, expandable storage. And now go and look at a Note 10. Oh, but we have to make fun of the Note 5, of the Galaxy S5, because the back kind of looks a little bit like a Band-Aid. Ugh, how could you even use a phone that doesn't look super nice? Ugh. And we gave it all up. We've lost so much. We've given it all away. Yeah, it's super, super exhausting. Oh, and from MavMech 13, I think it got exhausting when every single OEM decided to release a new phone every single year. And not just one phone, releasing multiple phones every single year. Even OnePlus fell for that. Let me get this out. Now we're just all remembering, oh, flat front faces, and oh, I miss my LG G4. The best Samsung phones were the Alpha and the Note 4. Oh, man, I am so mad I wasn't able to hold on to my Galaxy Alpha. I loved that phone. If only it had expandable storage. But the design... it was like a baby Note 4, these sort of slightly bulgy reinforced corners, the grippy back material, you could pop it open and replace the battery. This was peak Samsung. It's been downhill for Samsung ever since the Note 4, and the Galaxy Alpha was right there. And it drives me nuts that the only solution we had after that was to go to glass on glass sandwiches. But I digress. Okay, so I had a couple other stories. I'm going to be cutting them. Other things talking about Facebook and antitrust and Facebook using Breitbart as a legitimate news source. And there is a story I'm going to leave linked in the show notes that I hope you all will go and check out from NBC News, of all places. Google's claims on quantum computing. This is something I need to be doing a better job of keeping tabs on. This is the future of data and services and infrastructure. And Google and IBM are having a little back and forth on what quantum superiority is really going to look like. Google claims that they have used a quantum computer to solve a mathematical problem that would take a traditional supercomputer 1,000 years. IBM claims that that same problem could be solved in 2 days. So again, it's how we benchmark. We have problems benchmarking phones. We can only imagine that the issues in benchmarking supercomputers much more difficult to quantify. But I really, really want to start digging more into things like quantum computing. The potential and the raw capabilities, pretty astounding. What we might be able to do. But this is where we're going to change gears for just a bit and talk about supporting your local content creator. I'm going to sort of skip my normal spiel. It's getting tough out there for a YouTuber. We want to find active participation. We want to find ways that we can actively support someone when we enjoy their content, not just passive views. So one of my solutions, of course, I'm always game to share things on social media, but every podcast has a subreddit, right? Usually it's a subreddit where people want you to contribute stories or leave comments or talk about how great they are. My subreddit is a platform to hopefully try and share content from people who need or deserve more attention. So it's reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. You can self-promote on Glowing Rectangles, which is usually a big no-no on Reddit. If you want to share your own content, your own videos, your own editorials, your own written articles, as long as there's a loose tech focus, please contribute. But it's also a platform for you to share other content creators' work and to share work from people who deserve more attention. So not just, oh, this person only has 1,000 subscribers and he's trying to monetize. We lose valuable voices in the tech space. I bring up an example like Patrick Norton. Patrick Norton used to produce this awesome weekly show, and it wasn't getting shared, and people weren't participating. It was difficult to find sponsors. That show vanishes. That show was really good. Tech thing was great. Now it's gone. So even when you think, oh, someone's good, they've got like 1 million subscribers, they're doing fine, the current economy for making things on the internet has never been more brutal. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. You can use this as a base to find new content creators. You can use this as a place to support your favorite content creators. LFA reviews. It's tough out here on these YouTube streets. He ain't lying. It's rough. So these are the top stories this week from, let me get this queued up here. What the heck? I'll go ahead and drop the Reddit link here in the live chat, which this will automatically take you to the top stories of this last week. Digging in at the top of the charts, my buddy, my pal, my TK Bay, sharing his impressions after 3 days using the Pixel 4 XL. Again, we're all in this race to try and create content, try and provide some fresh spin on analysis. Day zero reviews are a major pain in my butt as a content creator. By the time I'm able to get a video out, it feels like a product's already been talked to death. If you want that more nuanced or that more researched conversation on a product, you've got to follow up with some of these other producers over time. TK makes great stuff. Next up, this is a channel I just recently subscribed to, Life of Tech, in the number 2 spot. The world's first Wi-Fi 6 mesh system, the Asus AX6100. I am a huge fan of mesh. I'm currently running an Eero. But if you want that sort of gaming style router performance, some of the new stuff coming out from Asus is surprisingly good. And we're right on that cusp of 10 gig Ethernet supporting Wi-Fi 6 and being able to spread that out over a multinodal Wi-Fi system. Huge. So what is it? Life of Tech only has 7,000 subscribers. Only 7,000 people are following this stuff. And it's a pretty good look. Well shot, very well articulated. This is someone that should be on your radar. It's good commentary. And rounding out the top three, what's this? An editorial from some jerk face who wears hats. Silly tech geeks, of course the Pixel 4 is worth $100 more than an iPhone 11. We might have brought that up during the housekeeping. But if you hate this guy's face, because he has a punchable face, you don't have to worry about this editorial because it's a written article. So you don't even have to see his face while he's talking about how it's pretty obvious that a Pixel 4 should carry a $100 price premium
over an iPhone 11. Cause he's a jerk. So yeah, I make this plea every week. Matt Tyler, there we go. Hashtag some punchable face guy. Abraham Artemis, that jerk also wrote an editorial. How dare he? I make this plea every week. This is always the midpoint of our podcast, often sort of the two-thirds point of our podcast. It's great when you find someone new and you watch all their stuff. That's really not enough to sustain a content creator these days. And active participation is what builds a community anyway. If you want to engage with these people as they're making cool stuff and you want to bring other people to that party and share things that you're passionate about, it's the activity, it's the action, it's the participation that means so much. It's why I like doing this podcast with a live stream and a live chat, and I can see how you folks are really reacting to this stuff in real time. And we've gotten into some pretty heady debates. Obviously, I mean, what I love is a lot of you disagree with me on these topics, but we've been able to broach these conversations with substance and with emotions and with passion, but also by hashing out some pretty difficult concepts with facts and with facts and with feelings. I wouldn't be doing this if it were just me talking out into the ether. I didn't want to get into YouTube to make videos and then have everyone tell me how cool my videos are in the comments. Every video that I've ever made, I've felt has been the first start of a forum post. So a forum, you expect conversation and debate and deliberation and examination. And that's what I enjoyed coming up into tech as soon as I got an internet connection and I was on message boards. You find someone new or you find someone struggling, there's so much you can do to help. And that participation is critical to keeping fresh content served to your feeds. If you go to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, you will see a broader set of discussions. It won't, I promise you, it's not going to be just whatever's the hottest flavor of the week. The top 10 stories, we've got an Oppo Reno Z2 review. We've got Flossie Carter, someone shared his Nubia Red Magic 3S review. I shared Luis Rossman's right to repair testimonial. We've got LFA talking about the Liberty 2 Pro from Soundcore, another great pair. From Anchor, some true wireless headphones. Nick Gray over at Fandroid doing a Pixel 4 versus iPhone 11 Pro camera comparison. We've got Rap Tech review from C Kid Tech. We've got a super review talking about some headphones that I can't pronounce. Again, there is a huge variety of topics out there. If you go through your YouTube feed, what YouTube wants to use to keep you on YouTube is going to be a very limited set of discussions. You're going to see a ton of Apple, a ton of Samsung, and then some pop-up, this is popular right now, OnePlus or Pixel videos. That is not what the tech community is talking about. That is what YouTube is trying to focus you on because it's fitting the most popular aspects of their algorithms. Reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. If you've never been before, I guarantee you, you'll find someone that you really like, that you've never seen before. If you go regularly, don't be stingy with the upvotes, drop some comments, participate, share some stuff, and we can keep making this community more robust. We just broke 500 members on Glowing Rectangles. This is not an exercise in popularity. This is an exercise in organically building a real community of tech enthusiasts and tech fans. LFA Reviews, Life of Tech is a friend of mine. His videos are 100,000 plus sub quality since he started. Only 7,000 subs is such a travesty for his content quality. From 20 Miles, 1975, even if we don't always agree, the discussion must always be had. It's a great way to learn and engage with different communities. And from MavMech 13, C-Kid is effing dope. I just joined the Reddit, also just officially signed up for Reddit to join the Reddit. So MavMech 13 on Mixer, thanks for supporting, thanks for participating, thanks for sharing. All right, got a couple tech topics to wrap this show up with. And if you have any questions, or I mean, if it hasn't already been talked to death for you, we're going to close out the show talking the Pixelbook Go, which I have right over here on the side. I was thinking, is there a way I could run my podcast from the Pixelbook? I couldn't quite find all of the little pieces I needed, but it's a goal that I have, is to fully produce one of these shows from either a Chromebook or from an Android phone. But if you've got questions, comments, concerns about Pixelbook, Chrome OS, etc., have those ready, because we'll be wrapping the show up with that. Oh man, it is super smoky out here. I'm very surprised my voice has held out as well as it has. So I was on the Android Police podcast and we talked about RCS messaging. I think it is going to be pretty disastrous when the carriers get together to make their own standard for RCS, and they are purposely excluding Samsung and Google. So the two biggest players in the space that could leverage user bases and operating systems and software to help combat iMessage, let's cut them out of the equation. As much as I have issues with Samsung and the way that they've kind of positioned some of their solutions and some of their software products, omitting Samsung from a messaging platform is maybe one of the dumbest things you could possibly do. So Ryan over at Android Police, AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Verizon enter into new RCS messaging joint venture. I don't know anyone who thinks that this is a good idea or that this will be the messaging app that they will want to use. But we're going to see a cross-carrier, cross-Android phone app that you can use for messaging. It's going to be based on, air quotes, a universal platform. I don't know. We talked about it at length during the the Android Police podcast, but I just don't believe that our carriers have ever entered into a services solution like this with the intention of actually providing the better service. Dating back to ISIS, you know, trying to block Google Wallet. Again, this is a net neutrality issue of carriers being able to leverage their networks and their infrastructure against competition. We saw that fail spectacularly, and it basically just led to the rise of Apple Pay being the sort of gold standard for mobile payment solutions, with AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Verizon deciding that they'll be the keepers of RCS. All I see is this leading to further proliferation of alternative messaging platforms and iMessage still being held up as the de facto gold standard for messaging. 20 Miles brings up the point. This is also news that kind of broke over the weekend that there is an RCS solution for Google Messages and the Google Messaging app that you can lay out right now. I'll be curious to see, like, what does this mean as a protocol when we don't really seem to have a true standard like we did for SMS? Right now, SMS and MMS are basically the main methods that my family uses to communicate. We're not looking to jump on. I tried to get my family onto Hangouts. Google nuked Hangouts. Duo is kind of becoming the main service for video calling. Just between our iPhone and Android family members, Duo seems to be the one app that's rising up as the standard. We're all kind of putting Skype to bed and using Duo instead. But just for punching out a group communication or some type of text-like message, text messaging still wins. And I think one of the things that we're going to have to take a look at is also privacy and security situations. So I'm going to link to this Reddit post, which has a couple other useful links in the body of the message. But it's something that we also brought up on the Android Police podcast, is RCS is a data protocol. It's a an internet-based communication standard, not the messaging standard that's built into sort of the backbone of the telecommunications infrastructure. So we've got some concerns. We've got some concerns over carriers and Google being able to sort of listen in on conversations. Will they be end-to-end encrypted? It appears that Google has kind of walked back that. Although RCS chat is not yet end-to-end encrypted, there is at least one small piece of good news in how Google has implemented it. Ronnie says that the company doesn't keep any of the messages that pass through its servers. Quote, from a data retention point of view, we delete the message from our RCS backend service the moment we deliver it to an end user. If we keep it, it's just to deliver it when that person comes online. But that also means in the milliseconds of time that a message is on a Google server, it doesn't appear to be encrypted. It appears to be an open piece of text that can be referenced and can be accessed. So again, if you're looking at like, well, how do I communicate with people and I care about privacy and I care about security, then RCS might not be the fit. It might not be the solution. And we might be looking at other yet another type of messaging service to try and protect our communications. From Baraketh, someone claiming to be a network engineer at Verizon claimed it will be supposedly built on top of the Universal Profile 2.3 and the CCMI crap is the business side of things. So the whole like carrier consortium of messaging. I don't think that's what CCMI stands for. That sounds not true coming from someone at Verizon, but okay, we'll go with that until we have evidence to support something different. From Gary the Fireman replying to 20 Miles, replying to Sam, it's nice to have something like iMessage without having to buy an iPhone. We've all been waiting to see some kind of iMessage style competitor. And the fact that iMessage is, it's a locked up and closed gardened ecosystem for iPhone and iOS users means that most of the cell phone carrying population doesn't have a unified messaging solution like that. And we'd like to see something, but the more we see these competing, again, air quotes, standards come out, the more I think it's just going to be like, I know I've got friends that if I want to talk to them, I can only talk to them on a Twitter DM. I've got a couple friends where I'm only going to be chatting with them on Instagram. It's just, you're going to kind of learn, if I want to talk to this person, it's most likely that I'll reach them on this service. That's kind of what the near-term future of messaging is going to resemble. But if you want to play with RCS, there have been a handful of articles. I'll try and find a good one that can kind of walk you through step by step. It's not difficult. It doesn't seem like it's difficult to enable RCS messaging on Android right now. And if you desperately wanted to have that communication back and forth with someone where you could see the little dots as they were typing their message, it's coming. And I think there's a way to activate it on Google servers. So that'll be the jam for a bit, I guess. I don't know. I really don't understand, like, when these protocols are enacted, will the carriers be able to do anything to disrupt an RCS messaging platform built by Google? Because we saw they were very effective in halting Google Wallet. So I wonder, what are they going to be doing here? Sorry, this apropos of nothing, at Frat Produce just commented, holy ish, I just found a Palm phone on display at Best Buy in the Verizon section. Was it the little Palm, like the little pocket watch phone that they came out with? Or are you saying like you found a Palm Pre? If you found a Palm Pre, I'll be very impressed. Abraham Artemis, coming from a place where almost all people here either use Line or WhatsApp, what the hell are you people talking about? And from Charlie Spirit Song, replying to Abraham, I share your sentiments exactly. All right. One last news story before we get to the Pixel Book. This is coming by way of Engadget, but this is also something we talked about on Android Police, and a number of outlets have been talking about it. Red founder retires and the hydrogen phone project is over. This is Engadget, written up by Richard Lawler. And oh, Red, how you've made the market more difficult to support new players walking into this market. At the age of 70, Red founder Jim Jannard has announced he's retiring, saying that between his age and a few health issues, it is now time. As he steps away from the company, he also announced its hydrogen phone project will end after producing just one device. When the hydrogen one arrived late last year, it brought some technology like 4V for its display and image capture that was innovative, but it didn't live up to its $1,295 price tag. I am, yes, please in the live chat, press F to pay your respects. I am so frangry, frustrated, and angry with companies that walk into mobile with the reputation of another industry and the arrogance to think that they can be successful in a year or two. If you've been following any of the conversations that I've had on podcasts all the way back to the beginnings of the Board at Work, when I started joining Board at Work on his weekly show way back in the day, I have held to this hypothesis that you need, if you're a new player in a market, you need to have a business plan that accounts for three generations of failure before consumers start taking you seriously. I think the shining example that I point to in sort of like the laptop space would be Microsoft. From the first Surface to the Surface 3, we saw Microsoft iterate on design, prove to consumers that they were going to stick around, and also improve Windows. We went from Windows 8 to Windows 10 in that time frame also. But they also had to suffer around 3 years of tech nerds saying that their products were garbage and overpriced and not worth it for the monies, and no one wanted a tablet or a convertible slate, or if you did, you should just buy a Lenovo, and these things already existed. And oh, well, now that the Surface 3 is out, well, this is actually a very elegant computing solution, and all the problems have magically evaporated, and my philosophy on tablet convertible computers is now completely different now that other manufacturers are starting to copy the Surface lineup. Again, the tail wags the dog when it comes to tech commentary. Consumers started digging into those products, and as they were searching for commentary, tech reviewers saw that more consumers were looking into this stuff. And around the 3-year mark, that's when consumers started taking these products seriously enough that tech reviewers started giving them better reviews. I think another good example would be OnePlus. A company that I didn't really start taking seriously until around the OnePlus 3T. Around the OnePlus 3T, we saw a company that was pivoting out of just this sort of niche of Android enthusiasts and looking at how they could present their products in a more mainstream fashion, in a more capable fashion. And we get to the OnePlus 5, and that's a company that's really starting to execute some top-tier products. But again, it's at around the OnePlus 3T that we see that shift and we see that perspective change, and we see consumers starting to get more interested in what they have to offer. I don't have a Red Hydrogen One, but all of the signs were there for imminent failure. I don't understand how anyone at Red could look at the smartphone market, look at what they were designing to compete in the smartphone market, and think, yeah, first gen product, gonna nail it. We're really gonna be coming out swinging and consumers are gonna love what we have to offer. I have a similar angst, sort of a frangry response to Razer. Like, that got so brutal, like, I might not go with Razer for my next laptop. I'm so frustrated that we're super huge in the gaming space. Our customers love us. We're going to buy up a smartphone manufacturer. We're going to buy Nexbit and we're going to make a gaming phone. And then by the time you get to the second generation, they're pulling the plug. They had zero plan for really walking into mobile other than people love our label. We've got a great brand reputation. Our fans love us. We're going to be awesomely competitive. And that's not how this market works. You know, where you look at the luxury solution of a gaming laptop is a very different commodity than my daily driver phone. And convincing consumers that you're going to be around for their phone needs, completely different set of circumstances than convincing consumers you can be around for their boutique gaming computer needs. So the reason why I get so frustrated is because every single time one of these companies limps into a tech space with no plan for multi-year failure and then immediately like limps right back out again, it just continues to confirm why consumers should never take a chance on a new company. You could consider buying like my Focals, my super awesome heads-up display glasses that I love. I love this product. It's a premium luxury product. It's an expensive ask, but it's so good at what it does. But you know what? Why try the Focals when in a couple years, Apple will give you something with less functionality at a higher price tag? Just wait for Apple. Don't ever take a risk. Don't ever take a chance. Don't ever put yourself in a position where you might have your heart broken. No, no, no. We've seen even Red couldn't make a phone. Razer couldn't figure out gaming phones. No, no. Those companies are really good at what they do, and they still failed in the market. And that's what drives me crazy. There's like a cynical approach to Red getting into smartphones. I don't feel like they really approached it with earnest. They looked at a market that they felt like they could muscle in based on their reputation. And then that backfired. And it backfired so badly that they only made one phone. At least Razer made two phones. I've got my Razer 2 right here. I'll use this as my stand-in for the Red Hydrogen because I'm almost as frustrated with Razer as I am with Red. That this phone was getting really good. And a Gen 3 would have started pushing people over. They just needed some savvier marketing. They needed to put some boots on the ground. And they needed to stop trying to leverage their relationship with gamers to convince people that this could have been a top-tier product. Asus is playing this smarter. They're doubling down on their smartphone efforts. They're building more cost-competitive devices. And they seem to be getting the market better. So not only just an ROG phone, but a Zenfone. Interesting stuff and a compelling option for unlocked cell phone consumers. Razer and Red, man, just pissing me off. from DCJ Reviews on Mixer. Red really should have just concentrated on the camera tech instead of trying to make the holy crap of all phones. How hilarious it is that they not only completely misread the smartphone market, that they didn't even bring any of what makes their company interesting to the table in their phone. Their Gambit on 3D was a failed technology years before they started making a phone. Who gets excited about 3D? Like, are you shopping your next TV based on its 3D capabilities? And instead of doing something that they could have leveraged, a camera solution that rivaled top camera producers in a Huawei style, you know, like where Huawei was putting some brutal hardware up into their cameras to really compete against Apple and Samsung. Instead, they went on 3D. Dumb. So dumb. From Fat Produce, not only are, again, I don't know what you're trying to say at the beginning there, but also the sheer arrogance of charging what they charged for their phone and thinking that they would be successful within a year or two. It's all based on, again, arrogance is the perfect word. People love our label. We're going to do this and people will love it because it's us and we don't need to actually have a different solution or a different product in mind. Oh, people didn't love it? Okay, well, let's just verify why people should only buy Apple and Samsung. Only buy Apple or Samsung. Those are the only safe plays because they're the most popular. And obviously they're the most popular, not because those companies spend billions of dollars on advertising and product placement and market retail locations and putting their gadgets into people's hands. And, you know, it's not that they're bad products, but it's a true meritocracy. That's why Apple and Samsung are always the only options to consider, is because they're the best. Sure. From Du Mur, the thing with innovative companies is that they usually lack the marketing to get their products into consumers' hands. So when they close down, Google, Apple, Samsung takes what's left, which are the ideas that those companies put out. And I feel like tech reviewers and tech enthusiasts now in this age play into that. Like, how many times have you been in a review on a product and you're like, well, but don't get this one. Wait for Gen 3. This is a raw technology. You don't want to use it now. Don't buy it now, but wait until it's refined. And we're actively telling people not to support companies that are really trying to deliver new experiences and new products and exciting new takes on technology. The tech enthusiasm community is actively supporting the duopoly of Samsung and Apple. That nothing is a good idea until Samsung puts it into their phone. Or now wireless charging is worth it because Apple finally got on board. That's completely backwards. We should be the bleeding edge. And again, that also means we occasionally put ourselves out there in a way that we get our hearts broken. But I pry my focals from my cold, dead hands. These things are amazing. And again, if you're wearing glasses, they're not as expensive. I didn't realize that, buying glasses can still be pretty pricey. Adding smart frames to your repertoire with prescription lenses, not that bad. So with that in mind, let's talk about another new piece of exciting technology. Noob Master X6. I don't know how to say your name, Noob Master. Hot news, AirPods Pro when official. Okay. Let me find AirPods Pros. I don't want to talk about AirPods Pro. You can't make Pro earbuds. Where? Come on, Apple. Just give me the $250, and they still look terrible. All right, so so it took me to the Apple store page. There we go. It's just apple.com. AirPods Pro, magic like you've never heard. Learn more or buy. Well, let's learn more about the AirPods Pro. They look like hair dryers. They look like they're still completely sealed. And I doubt that they'll be any better. Oh, active noise cancellation for immersive sound. So not only has Apple figured out that we want an inner aural earbud to properly block the ear canal, they're also going to add active noise cancellation. That's great. Transparency mode for hearing what's happening around you. A customizable fit for all-day comfort. Basically, these are Jabras. Magic, like you've never heard before except for Jabra. And they still look terrible. They're even chunkier. They stick out from the ear further. $250. Ooh, look, you can choose what size ear tip you want to put into them so that they fit your ear better. This is technology that Apple has refused to give us since the dawn of the iPod. There is no reason why free earbuds from Apple couldn't include the pennies worth of silicone to give us a better fit in the ear. We have been supporting an industry, a company that has been damaging our hearing for over 10 years, and now their solution for this on their wireless product starts at $250. And it still looks like consumer e-waste, disposable, non-repairable crap. I don't know if I put them away. So I recently did a review on the Creative true wireless earbuds, the Creative Outlier Air Gold. If you go to Creative's website and you go like, oh, I want to look at the manual, right next to the manual is a white paper that shows you how to crack open the Creative so that you can replace the battery. The new Galaxy earbuds I don't think they sound that good. But if you're talking true wireless, iFixit has shown you can pop those open pretty easily to replace the battery. Even the charge cases on AirPods, not super easy to dismantle. You'll probably damage it and you won't really be able to fix that little casing. Creative and Samsung, you like pop the casing open and you replace the battery. And those things come in at half the price, less than half the price of these AirPod Pros.
Pardon the interruption here, but I need to plug another podcast I'm working on with my buddy Andrew. The Geek Book Club is a monthly podcast, which is also an online book club, which should not come as a surprise given the name of the podcast. We pick a book, we read it, and then we talk about it, and you can also join the conversation. If you want a good geeky chat about your favorite geek literature, join Andrew Wallace and I every month on the Geek Book Club, available on iTunes, Google Play, and other fine podcasting services.
I'm not feeling it. This is the company that revolutionized digital audio for consumers with the iPod, and they are now becoming one of the most consumer hostile companies for the tech that we actually put in our ears. You want active noise cancellation? You could go with One More's. The One More neckband has awesome noise cancellation. There are two earbuds I can't talk about yet that will probably also be adding some active noise cancellation. We're trying to act like this is magic and it's expensive. Want to hear what's happening around you? Just press and hold the force sensor on the stem to jump between active noise cancellation and transparency mode, which lets outside sound in and allows things to sound and feel natural when you're talking to people nearby. Okay, so that means if there's force pressure hardware on the AirPod, then that means this is not going to be a repairable product. This is automatically, by design, a disposable product with, more power-sapping hardware. The extra microphones for audio pass-through and for active noise cancellation and the extra processing power needed to drive noise cancellation like that means your battery life is going to degrade even faster because it doesn't look like the stems and the stalks that come out of here have much more room to pack in more battery. So let me see. I'm going to keep scrolling down on this. Here, I'll go back into the screen share. I want them to say anything. They're talking about the technology of the new H1 chip because Bluetooth isn't something that they can license. Here's the force sensor. They're sweat resistant, charge wirelessly. Let's see. They say 24 hours of listening time with multiple additional charges in the case. 4.5 hours of playback on one charge. 4.5 hours. The One More True Wireless Stylish, I think, are 6 hours. The Creative Outlier are now what? They're now up to 14 hours of playback on a single charge. Apple couldn't make this stuff work with 5 hours of playback in a charge. This is at the same tier as like the Jabra 65s, which have been around for years. That design from Jabra has been around for years. And Apple is now just catching up with a mini hairdryer. I didn't want to talk about this. It was just going to make me angry. We're going to talk about the Pixel Book, which was going to make me kind of happy. But here's the thing. They're going to talk about, I'm scrolling through the Apple website right now. They're talking about Siri. They're talking about for customization options. You can use augmented reality if you want a closer look at the AirPods Pro. There is nothing in here about sustainability. There is nothing in here about recycling. There is nothing in here about repairability. This is another terrible product for the environment. It's a better product for your ears. Thankfully, we now have a first-party Apple solution which isn't terrible for your hearing. But it's still going to be e-waste. They can only get 4.5 hours of playback brand new. If you use your headphones a lot, you're going to wreck that battery after the first year of use. And it's only going to cost you $250 for the privilege of an adequate audio experience that you'll have to replace after a year and a half, maybe 2 years, when you can go out and buy really nice headphones that will last you probably until you die if you take care of them. This makes me crazy. This stuff is just so frustrating. DCJ reviews, but their marketing is second to none. They invent everything, yo. And again, this is another opportunity. Like I was talking about in Our Glowing Rectangles, I'm an audio snob. I totally wear that. I own it. In the live chat right now, LFA reviews. If you're not following his channel, you are missing out on top tier headphone and audio commentary. He's a bro. He's a real good dude. He's super active on his platforms, on social media. He's always down to chat about different options. He gets really lit up about this stuff, and he knows what he's talking about. So, I mean, if you're not even going to take it from me, at least give him a shout, because he's good people. Let's see. From Arslan... Arezlan, I am so sorry. I opened my Jabra Elite 65T case to fix them because one of the magnets came off and it wouldn't turn off by putting them in the case anymore. It was quite easy to fix. That's great. I mean, again, I love hearing stories like that. And from a company like Jabra, because Jabra, they're owned by a manufacturer that makes hearing aids. I can't think of a company with a better reputation in the audio health space. But then also hearing like, oh yeah, if you need to crack something open and fix something, you can do it, which you won't be able to do on anything Apple makes. Matt Tyler, Apple just invented active noise canceling and long-lasting battery. Apple are amazing. It's so frustrating to me because they didn't. The long-lasting battery is totally specious. Again, I mean, like, you can kick a pair of Creative Outliers for $80, and they probably won't be as fancy or as nice looking if you think the AirPods look nice, but you'll get 10 hours of runtime, depending on how loud you listen, obviously, because that also takes a hit too. But there are better controls, better options for controlling the volume on the earbuds. You've got direct access to your Google Assistant or your Siri. The charge case has a bigger battery so you can keep them running out in the field longer. Just point by point by point. I can keep going. This is. Ah. Aditya Anil, hashtag some audio snob bros. I will happily wear that with LFA. LFA is a good dude. And again, I have different tastes in tuning than he does, which is also good to sort of cross our reviews against each other. But I will happily wear the banner of audio snob with Jeff. All right. Now, can we finally get to the end of the podcast that I had planned on, now that the show is already at 2 hours and thankfully I haven't gotten an evacuation notification from my phone? Excuse me. Pixelbook. The Pixelbook Go. Look at this. It's a Chromebook. It's a pretty thin Chromebook. It's not like a floppy or a creaky Chromebook. I can like hold it from one edge and I don't feel like any crazy case flex or plastic bits groaning. And it's it runs Chrome OS. And it's pretty decent hardware. It's really decent hardware for Chrome OS. And oh, look how fast it just woke up, because it just opened the lid. And I'm right back into my Chrome browser because it's a laptop. Oh, I'm getting texts and notifications coming in. Should probably not show that on camera for people's phone numbers. Let me just swipe those away. Let's minimize that. So, yeah, I've spent a couple days with the Pixelbook Go. This is the Core i5 model with 128 gigabytes of storage. And, this is the first return I've had to Chrome OS since Chromebooks first launched. We were looking at those like Acer Netbook competitors, and This is obviously a very different beast than what those original solutions were. And I'm definitely guilty of that stigma where Chrome OS was basically just a browser in a laptop shell. And there's a lot that you can do from that. Like, I recommended a Chromebook to my aunt. It was mostly about web surfing, doing a little bit of writing, but she didn't need to have full Microsoft Office support, and lots of video and streaming and stuff like that. Chromebook made perfect sense for her. And to replace like her old busted Windows laptop with like a $200 netbooky kind of computer, she loves that thing. But I've always kind of held to the, well, they're not really for me, but I can see a few people who I think would be interested in something like this. With some of the more recent updates to Chrome OS being able to sideload Android apps, this has been a very different beast than what I remember. Obviously, we've seen improvements from the dawn of Chrome OS to now. And the Pixelbook is making a very interesting argument for hardware. This is something that's going to be going into my sort of first look video. I'm hopefully going to be able to shoot that today and have it out sometime in the middle of the week, which is late for a first look video because I got my Pixelbook later than a lot of other people that were able to hit that day one embargo date for putting out videos. But for as much as I like what's going on here, the keyboard feels fantastic. It's got a headphone jack where the Pixel phone doesn't have a headphone jack. Sorry, I can't help myself. The keyboard is great. I really do like the feel of the keys for how quiet they are. That's a nice touch. This is hardware that feels both premium and cheap at the same time. Again, when you pick it up, and Google is making this commentary on, you should be able to easily hold it. You know, you just kind of folio like it's a folder. You can carry it with you. It's ribbed for your enjoyment. I mean, so many of these things are spot on. But it's funny in my brain that when I lift this off a table and it's so light and it's so portable, that to me has been like the hallmark of a cheap product. You know, like I kind of feel like Boris the Blade in Snatch, you know, wait, it's hefty, it's reliable, and you can throw them at it. You know, like it's that was a terrible Eastern European accent that I just did there. But for something that feels as solid, you know, again, like when I hold this thing from an edge and I'm doing that waggle right here, where a MacBook feels to me like it's about to bend. I had that happen to me on a MacBook 7 It was an Intel. It was one of the first Intel 17-inch MacBooks back in the day, where if you picked it up from the side, the case would crimp. That it was so much weight. And the leverage was so off. And the fact that we can do this with laptops now, especially these super thin and light laptops, is pretty remarkable. That's pretty incredible. I'm so excited about the build in that respect. And yet you look at it and you play with it and you open it and it still also kind of feels like a stereotypical Chromebook. And again, I'm having that internal conflict. Like, I'm not sure how to feel about that. Because this model, is this the $999 version? No, I think this is the $850 version. Let me look that up right now before we dig too into this. I haven't had a lot of time to play with it. Pixelbook Go. So my version is the Core i5-128 with 8 gigabytes of RAM. It's an $850 laptop. In terms of just raw specs, $850 for a decent Core i5, 8 gigabytes of RAM, 128 gigabytes of storage, that's not terrible. It's easy to find HPs and Dells not built as well that you can find for cheaper. And you're undercutting the pricing on a MacBook Air, an iPad Pro, a similar storage tier. You got to bump up a storage tier, or even a Surface laptop. It's not hard to find. It's not hard to find laptops that are cheaper, but this is undercutting some of the bigger, more visible players in this space. And $850, like I said, for this headphone isn't terrible. Charlie Spirit song. If you have to evacuate, remember the Megapickle mug. Excuse me. Aditya Anil, does the Pixel book have a grippy base? So this is ridged, but there's only like a rubbery material at the front and the back. So it's not, the whole thing isn't grippy. The shell is partly injection molded magnesium, which is one of the reasons why it feels so light and yet remains so sturdy. But this is the same sort of matte finish as the rest of the back. It's not grippy in a rubbery sense. It's grippy in that they've made this a George Foreman grill shape on the bottom. That's actually not a good comparison because it doesn't get that warm when you use it. Matt Tyler, Chromebook review incoming. Yeah, I'm going to be spending some time with Chrome OS. I've already been writing on it. Like I said, the two editorials that I wrote on SomeGadgetGuy.com were mostly written in Microsoft Word on my Pixelbook Go. From 20 miles, I have an HP Chromebook and it's aight, but yeah, just use my laptop. Let's see. From Matt Tyler, this would literally be perfect for me, videos and typing up some points and reviews and watching the stream instead of using my phone. So Matt Tyler, again, for some of the use that you've described, because Matt Tyler is in the Some Gadget Guy Discord chat. We were talking about he doesn't have a laptop. A Chromebook actually would make a lot of sense for you, Matt, because you're not looking at a lot of heavy use or legacy software, video editing and rendering, stuff like that. So that might be something worth looking into. And whether or not you jump on a Pixelbook, Chrome OS brings a lot of the same benefits regardless of what platform you run it on. From Abraham Artemis, as good as the design is, they didn't quite nail it like a Surface. Like the Surface, the look of the new Surface products is really clean. I'm kind of surprised that Google didn't follow up, because like the last Pixel that I remember running Chrome OS had that like two-tone look, you know, the mostly metal body with like that strip across the back. It was the same look that the Pixel phones had. Because, I mean, if you hold this up, this is just a black slate. This looks like any generic black laptop. But then you pick up a Pixel phone, let me take it out of its fabric case. And they've also gotten rid of the two-tone strip, but there is more color and detail and accent happening on a phone. I kind of feel like Google could have. I feel like they could have delivered a more unified product look across their different options. A single, maybe the power button has a color accent or a strip or part of the bezel has some different color or tone or look to it. I feel like they could have made their products look like one more unified ecosystem than what they did. From Elisna, my next Chromebook has to be a convertible and it's gotta be sub $300. I mean, it's not hard finding Chrome OS for cheap. I'll be curious to see how my experiences with a premium Chrome OS device last. I'm a little anxious about sideloading Android apps because this is an x86 computer. And what I alluded to at the beginning of this podcast, you know, Chrome OS was originally built to also run on ARM chipsets, and a lot of the apps that you will install on Chrome OS are Android apps that are now being run on x86 hardware. So there's a conversion at play. I haven't got a chance to test this yet, but it's my hypothesis that doing something a little bit more intensive, like playing an Android game on a Pixelbook, or like using one of my video editing Android apps on a Pixelbook will be noticeably faster and smoother on a phone than it will be on this premium laptop hardware. That is my guess. that when we have to convert an Android app to run in on an x86 hardware, that it'll be faster to do this stuff on a phone. Now, I just want to see, like, if I render a video on my Pixelbook, will it be able to beat my MateBook? So my 13-inch Huawei laptop is sort of my threshold now, because it's not very fast at rendering video. If I render 4K video, 1 minute of 4K video on that MateBook at a decent streamable quality, it's often about a 6 or a 7 to 1 rendering speed. So for every minute that I render, it takes 7 minutes for that laptop to put that video together. My Pixel carved up a very similar video rendering test in about a minute 30. So this phone was 4 times faster than my laptop at rendering the same video at the same quality. So now I want to see, will I take that kind of a performance hit on a Pixelbook if I want to try and do the same kind of work? I'm very curious to see, because I feel like this is now the version of Android that we always asked for. We've got the wealth of apps. You can install programs on a Chromebook. It's not just the browser, but the browser is a desktop grade. It's a true, real desktop grade browser. And Android has been kind of flirting with improved web browsing and getting us to that point. And now Chrome OS from the opposite side is giving us the more desktop style experience with a greater wealth of applications. And they're kind of meeting in the middle. I feel like it's 6 of 1, half a dozen of another. There's no reason why we couldn't have a phone running Chrome OS and have that real browser when we want it. Likewise, you know, what we're calling Android, what we're calling Chrome OS are now becoming the same thing. So that's the kind of like unification point I want to see as we start looking at whatever next generation operating system might come out of Google. So I'm going to scan through comments here. We're always running long on this podcast, but were there any other specific questions, anything that you wanted to know about the Pixelbook? I've been listening to some audio, streaming some videos from it. It connected great to my NAS, so I could stream directly through the NAS app and through Plex. From Gaz Broughton, 16 gigabyte is the average RAM. Actually, I mean, when you look at average, base model laptops usually start at 8, and it's not hard finding some solutions that still include 4. 16 became sort of that, this is the most that we could put into one of these mobile core i-series processor solutions. Like the most it could address was 16 gig, but that wasn't really the majority of what consumers were buying. The majority of people were shopping near the entry level, and that's usually 8 gigabytes of RAM. From Rosted, I think everyone in here will buy a Megapixel shirt. Should we start taking a collection of sizes? So I have one mock-up on taking this logo and turning it into just like a small little t-shirt logo. I'm still torn on whether or not I want to start putting text on the back of the shirt. So what I might do is offer like a mega logo, where it's just the Megapixels on the shirt and maybe like my Twitter handle underneath. And then maybe a smaller one where it's the little logo. And then on the back of the shirt, it says more than just the Megapixels. So I don't know. I'm playing around with those as two different designs. And hopefully we'll have the t-shirt ready to preview. I don't know that I'll have it out before the holidays, but I'm really going to try. From Goran Petrovic, latest news, breaking news, AI took over Google. Pixel 4 is designed by AI, priced by AI, and made for AI. We're getting there. Imagine if Juan dropped the phone now. Again, like, I'm so terrified, like, trying to do hand choreography while, like, oh, let me show you, and I'll do this thing, and let me open it so you can see. I'm totally going to pull a Linus if I keep doing, like, product hands-on during the podcast, because it's just way too much stuff to manage a podcast, look at the live chat, try and make eye contact with the camera, and hold a gadget up to the camera. From Doomer, if an Android app has x86 libraries, then there is no conversion being done. That's actually kind of a big if. You have to look into the developer notes. Like, I know PowerDirector specifically made reference to, in one of their updates, talking about better support for Chrome OS. It's not as cut and dry as whether or not they're looking at this, because so many developers are looking at the market. And while Chrome OS has a percentage of this market that I'm sure would be desirable, I'm not sure app developers are really courting Chrome OS as a market that they can make money on. From Abraham Artemist, I'm interested to see the comparison between this, an Intel-powered Chromebook, versus an ARM chip-powered Windows 10 device. And that's going to be a great fight. Because again, this is what I was alluding to at the beginning of the podcast. ARM versus x86. Intel and AMD versus Qualcomm and Apple and Helio and Kirin. I don't think they're as prepared for this onslaught of new consumer products that are going to be coming with mobile chips that are still incredibly powerful and able to get work done. And again, we're saying software to software. My hypothesis is the phone is going to do a better job of utilizing Android apps than the Pixelbook will. Ooh, that's a good one. Fat Produce, how about some Gadget Guy embroidery patches? Fat Produce just blew my mind, because I think that the Megapixel logo is ready to go for... Oh, that's good. Yeah, I'm going to look into that. I'm pretty sure I can pull that off. from Baraketh, I'm paranoid with caseless phones. I literally unwrapped my Pixel into its OtterBox case, and it only comes off to clean the cameras as necessary. yeah, I'm the same way. So I got the reviewer kit, and then in the reviewer kit for the Pixel 4, they were kind enough to give me one of the fabric cases, and I still need to get a screen protector on it. Same thing happened with my LG V50, where again, LG was kind enough to supply a reviewer unit for that Korean model. And I took the phone out of the box, put it down on a microfiber cloth, opened the dual screen case, put the phone in the case, and then put a screen protector on the phone. The screen has never felt the touch of human hands. Like, human fingers have never touched the screen on my LG V50. And I only pop it out of the case when I need to do some product photography or when I need to wipe it, because it gets kind of dusty in there. Megapixel pins, Megapixel hat. Okay, yeah. I'm going to have some stuff out for the holidays. We'll improve the merch store. I promise we'll get Team SGG gear happening here, in addition to the coffee mugs. And maybe I'll also bring back the bokeh shirt for the holidays as another just limited run, because I like being snarky and correcting people when they're wrong. But folks, that's going to do it. I'm going to have a lot of content coming out. Try and keep up with somegadgetguy.com, as I'm going to be trying to do a few more written articles. This week I am finishing up. I know I said I was doing this last week, but again, I kind of got interrupted with all of the fires and the evacuation prep. I will be finally finishing up the OnePlus 7T camera addendum. I'm not going to be doing the same full deep dive, because camera performance is pretty similar to the OnePlus 7 Pro, except for a handful of small features that I think people are really going to like. So that's going to be its own shorter form video, but that's going to be on the Patreon. I'm going to be doing my first look video for the Pixelbook Go. And again, just kicking off what I hope will be a fun experiment in using something different, because I haven't used Chrome OS for a really long time. And then there's going to be at least one more written editorial where I'm looking at another comparison, price performance. I'm pretty sure it's going to be Pixel 4 XL versus my OnePlus 7. Actually, real quick, before I go, in the live chat right now, should I compare a $1,000 Pixel 4 XL against a OnePlus 7 Pro, which has, it's the higher priced OnePlus 7, the screen matches better, the same chipset, or should I try and position the comparison against the OnePlus 7T, which is the newer OnePlus, but has the lower resolution display and has the newer chipset? What are your thoughts? I'm leaning towards OnePlus 7 Pro because I feel like those two products are actually more comparable in how OnePlus built their nicer phone and how Google is positioning the Pixel 4 as a premium option against iPhones. What do you think? Real quick, just drop a comment. Gary the Fireman says Pixel versus 7 Pro. Fat Produce says 7 Pro. Sam says 7 Pro. Charlie says compare all three. Interesting. Aditya Anil says 7 Pro. Arezlan says the Pro. I'm feeling like we're leaning towards the Pro. And then maybe I can also sneak in a little commentary on the 7T. All right. That helped. I needed that. good. Oh, yeah, an LFA, Charlie Spirit song, all saying the 7 Pro. Okay, so I'm going to write up a comparison, Pixel 4 XL, and similar to what I did for my V50, Pixel 4 XL versus the OnePlus 7 Pro. And then we'll see how that showdown goes down. OnePlus has earned quite a bit of respect, even though their launch strategy this year has been very scattered in what regions are getting what phones and what features and what devices. So from Fat Produce, you can get very close to a Pixel-like experience with a rooted OnePlus 7 Pro, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Goran Petrovic, you're sucking up to Juan. 3A versus Pixel 4. Actually, I mean, I really wished, again, I'm not going to look a review device gifted in the mouth, but I was really hoping I was going to get the smaller Pixel 4 because I wanted to do like a Pixel 3A, a smaller Pixel 3A versus a smaller Pixel 4 should make for a really fun showdown. But I just can't quite bring myself to do a video on the $400 3A versus the $1,000 XL with any kind of seriousness. All right, so let's wrap this up. Folks, lots more coming to the channels. Hopefully some more coming to the merch store. Maybe I'll also look at some stickers and some patches and some pins. That could be really cool. Thank you so much for all of those suggestions. Again, I probably wouldn't have stumbled onto that on my own had it not been for the live chat here on the podcast. You know where you can find me around the rest of the socials, at Some Gadget Guy on the Twitters and the Twitch and the Facebooks and the Instagrams and the YouTubes and all of those various places and social media outlets. But let's keep these conversations going. Again, any help, support, sharing for not only this podcast and my videos, but also the community of people out there that are trying to support their favorite content creators, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Again, we're all in this together, and I think we all share this one main goal. We want to watch cool stuff. We want to read cool stuff, and we're all willing to support our favorite producers, our favorite creators. We can spread that message and we can be the change we want to see in the world. So I'm eternally, always grateful for those of you that are on this ride, that have joined these conversations, joined these discussions, and are helping to promote similar kinds of content and similar kinds of conversations. So catch me back here next week, hopefully with fewer fire warnings. If you know, or if you meet any of the firefighters in your neighborhood, like I said, shake their hand, give them a nod, give them a fist bump. If you can, if you have the means to, buy them a meal, buy them a beer. Just show them that they're appreciated, because sometimes I feel like this can be thankless work. And it's some of the most necessary work in our society when catastrophes happen and they're the people that literally run into fire to try and make our lives better. So they need all the help they can get. all the support they can get from their communities too. The main theme of this podcast this week, appreciate, because I appreciate you. And I'm sure you appreciate them too. So thanks so much for tuning in, for sharing, for joining the live chat. This was an amazing live chat again. Thank you so much. And I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I want you to have a fantastic week with your technology. I want you to do awesome with your tech. I want you to be awesome with your tech. And I'll catch you back here next week. I love you all. Take care.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs, is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.